I am very intrigued that the second, the third, and the fourth chapters of the Song of Solomon, or to give the book its proper title, the Song of Songs, that's to say the best song of all, because it's a song of love, these three chapters, 2, 3, and 4, should so stand together and hold together so that they're almost a unit on their own. The second half of chapter 2 spills over naturally into the first half of chapter 3. And then the first half of chapter 3 leads naturally to the second half of chapter 3. And the second half of chapter 3, it opens the way for the two parts of the chapter which we read this evening. Now, this is how I see it. In the second half of the second chapter, this peasant girl who has been abducted by King Solomon and carted off to his harem is longing for her shepherd love. And she's standing, in the second half of chapter 2, she's standing at the lattice of the harem one day, and she's looking through the fretwork, and she sees her soulmate, her country boy, and he's peering in through the lattice, because he also is seeking his true love. In chapter 2 and verse 8, she says, "The voice of my beloved, her country boy, behold, he comes, leaping upon the mountains and bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Behold, there he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, Arise, my love, my fair one, come out of that awful place and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in the land.'" The end of verse 13, "Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away." That's the message. The seeking lover, Christ seeking us, looking through the windows of our heart and knocking at the door of our heart, the lover seeking his beloved. But in the story, she is not disposed to come to him and starts playing silly, skittish, girlish games. She goes all coquettish, all flirty. There are some chaps who don't like flirty girls. And the lover departs. And so in the first half of chapter 3, she starts looking for him. Actually, she's lying on her bed, on her couch in the harem, and she's dreaming of her boyfriend, or rather she's daydreaming of him. And the first half of chapter 3 is that lovely dream in which she chases her boyfriend, and eventually she finds him. Chapter 3 and verse 1. "Upon my bed by night, I sought him in a dream, whom my soul loves. I sought him in a dream, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer." So she says, "I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. The watchman, the policeman, the legalists found me. As they went about the city, legalists, she says to them, have you seen him whom my soul loves? They don't answer. Legalists don't care for people who love the shepherd, you see. And later on, they give her a good beating up when she loses her lover again and she's found in the streets and they punch her up. Horrid. Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's chamber, my mother's house. Beautiful, wonderful psychology that. That's what Isaac did with Rebecca, you know, when he married her. He took her into Sarah's tent. She was a kind of second mother to him because Sarah had died. Until I brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. And then suddenly the dream becomes a nightmare. Because at verse 6, suddenly she sees King Solomon again. And here he is, from verse 6 onwards, coming in a royal procession. And he's out to besiege the girl again and woo her and seduce her with his fair promises, just as the world comes to Christians and tries to seduce them from Jesus Christ. What is that coming up from the wilderness? Here's the nightmare. Like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of the merchant, behold, it is the bed of Solomon. Solomon's bed, his litter. About it are 60 mighty men of the mighty men of Israel. Verse 9. King Solomon made himself a palanquin from the wood of Lebanon. He made it posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple. It was lovingly wrought within by the daughters of Jerusalem, the ladies of the harem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon, the worldly king, with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. Which one? On the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. Now, this is the sort of situation that takes us into chapter 4 that we read this evening. Because it is out of this nightmare that the first half of chapter 4 comes. Because here, in these first five verses with their exaggerated Oriental poetry, King Solomon is laying siege to the peasant girl's virtue. Behold, you are beautiful, my love, he says. Behold, you are beautiful, your eyes are doves, your hair is like a flock of goats, your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes. Now, lots of you have said to me, how can you tell the difference between the worldly voice of Solomon and the voice of the shepherd love? How do you tell the difference? How can you separate the voices that besiege the girl? All right then. Is it not true to your Christian experience that it's not always easy to separate the voices that besiege you from day to day? Mercy. We live in such a babel of a world that it's hard to separate the good from the better and the better from the best. And it's sometimes very, very hard to separate the good from the bad. You see, the voice of Jesus has many competitors in this babel of a world in which we live. You see, When you become a Christian, you become a battlefield. Every Christian is a battlefield, and the battle is between Jesus and Satan. Now, of course, it's not an equal contest, because the death of Jesus Christ has dealt a mortal blow to Satan. But the battle is still there, and it is real. Every Christian is a battlefield. I think all those silly Victorian hymns and many of the mission hall hymns about being happy all the day and all the clouds vanishing when you come to Christ, I think they're just a lot of nonsense. Certainly unreal, not true to reality. The clouds don't all disappear when you become a Christian. You can't go through your Christian life grinning like a Cheshire cat all the time, can you? Battleground of voices. Doesn't the New Testament tell you to try the spirits, the voices, and see whether they come from God or not? Well, how can you tell the difference between Solomon and the girl's peasant love, her true love, her soulmate, her country boy? How can you tell the difference? Well, I think there is a way of telling. What Solomon promises, what the false lover promises, is quite different from what the true lover promises the girl. Yeah. When Solomon comes in, you find yourself in a world of luxury and extravagance. Reading these first five verses, did you not think it was all a bit too much? If I was the girl, I would say, oh, look here, come now. Comparing her fluttering eyelashes to doves. Or her tresses, her lovely, black, luxurious hair. Comparing that to a pack of goats struggling down Mount Gilead. Or telling a girl that she's got lovely white teeth, and you're very pleased to see that none of them are missing. That's what he says to the girl. Don't you think that's a bit much? I wonder what the reaction of some of our discotheque ladies would be to these compliments. It's a world of extravagance. But when the true shepherd comes in, the shepherd of her soul, the things he promises are simple and natural. Jesus Christ is simple and natural. Oh, that Christians would learn the naturalness and the simplicity of Jesus Christ. He's not a country bumpkin, although some people thought he was. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? You know, Nathaniel. Nazareth? That cabbage patch. How could anything good come out of Nazareth? Well, Jesus came out of Nazareth, and there is a naturalness and a simplicity in him. You see what he promises the girl? All the things come from God's own nature. Verse 6, day dawning and shadows fleeing. Nature. Verse 8, lions and leopards. Nature. Verse 9, one jewel, as contrasted with the arsenal of King Solomon in the first five verses, all the jewelry around her neck. He says, oh my, it's like shields, like warrior shields. But the true shepherd says, my dear, just one jewel turned my heart. In verse 10, natural things, wine, oils, and spices. Verse 11, natural things, nectar, honey, and milk. That's verse 11. Verse 12, there's the garden. How lovely. The garden. Verse 13, the orchard and the fruits. Could you be nearer nature? verses 14 and 15. Look at all the natural things there. Nard, saffron, calamus, cinnamon, frankincense, myrrh, aloes, chief spices. And there again in verse 15, a garden fountain, a well of living water, a spring in the garden. Absolutely wonderful. Now I think that this is the test between the voices. One is extravagant and overdone and vulgar and luxurious and carnal and sensuous and worldly. The voice of Jesus says, come and be natural. Come and be simple. Now, this evening from chapter 4 and verse 6 onwards, I want you to see three things, three beauties. First of all, the beauty of the bride. Secondly, the beauty of their relationship. And thirdly, the beauty of her separation. First of all, the beauty of the bride. Verse 7, he says to her, you are all fair, my love. There is no flaw in you. And that's what he thinks of her. She is, in his eyes, absolutely perfect. And she knows it. You may remember that I suggested to you in chapter 1 that what he thought of her, verse 5, chapter 1 and verse 5, what he thought of her kept her sane and true to him in that hellhole of a harem. What her sweetheart thought of her, I am very dark, but comely. You see, she was dark compared with the ladies of the harem. She was a swarthy lass with a rather sunburnt skin. Whereas the ladies of the harem were polished, professional, sophisticated city girls. I am very dark, but comely. I like the Authorized Version translation. Black, but beautiful. And it was because he thought she was beautiful that she stayed true to him. She may have thought herself unworthy. Isn't it time some more adherents were coming to the Lord's Supper? This thing in the Highlands about not coming because you're not worthy. You'll never be worthy. Nobody who comes to this table is worthy. I'm not worthy. Nobody. You see, it's not what you think about yourself that matters. It's what Jesus Christ thinks about you. She may have thought herself unworthy, black, you know, swarthy. And others may have thought she was unworthy as well. But the lover of her soul thought she was just great. He thought she was beautiful. You are all fair, my love. There is no flaw in you. I think that that's one of the most important things any Christian can learn, especially early on in the Christian life. That the loveliness and the perfection we have as Christians is not something that comes from ourselves. It's not our loveliness and perfection. It's not our flawlessness and our fairness. It's the loveliness and the perfection that have been given to us by Jesus Christ. That's why Christ can look at us tonight and say, you are all fair, my love. There is no flaw in you. Because the flawlessness and the perfection have been projected into us by Him. What does the New Testament tell us to do? It tells us to dress ourselves up in Christ. Put on the Lord Jesus Christ. We are to put Him on. We are to dress ourselves up in the robe of His righteousness and His perfection, so that what He sees in us is Himself, like a mirror. It's His own beauty. I wonder if you know, it would have been nice if we would have sung this anthem today, "Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness," that verse from the Psalms. What does that mean? Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Well, there's another translation, and it's a better translation. It goes like this, and this is what the verse really means. Worship the Lord in holy array. And the reference is to the high priest in the Old Testament, who had such gorgeous clothes that they were called the garments of glory and beauty. And when he had on all these gorgeous clothes, he was fit for the presence of God. He could go through the holy place and into the holiest place of all in his garments of glory and beauty. Now, in exactly the same way, Jesus Christ, who is our great high priest, dresses us up in his clothes. He takes us into his house, and he takes us upstairs into the wardrobe. He says, "I think I've just got the very thing for you." The robes of his own perfection and his own loveliness. There was an old lady in Portsoy called Georgina MacDonald. My good friends that Nichols will remember Georgina. I could never remember her in her heyday. But I can also recall my mother saying to me that when she was young, she was always the belle of the ball, because the MacDonalds were an adventurous seafaring family. They went to China and Burma, and the old rickety house was stuffed with all the treasures that the previous MacDonalds had brought home. And so, whenever there was a fancy dress parade in Portsoy, we used to go round to Georgina's. And she was pretty frail, she was an invalid at the time, but she directed operations from the bed, and she would say, "Now, go to that wardrobe." And we would go, open the door, and a whole world gone by was hanging there. Absolutely marvelous. Victorian clothes and Edwardian clothes. Feather boas, you know. Absolutely fabulous. And we would dress up for the parade. Now, in the same way, Jesus takes repentant sinners. It's not for anybody. It's for repentant sinners. Into his wardrobe, and he gives us his garments of glory and beauty. He projects his beauty onto us. And then he admires himself in us. It's like narcissism. He admires himself in us. His work and his perfection. Do you know that this great passage from Isaiah chapter 61? You care to turn it up? Isaiah chapter 61. The beauty of the bride. I love these words. Isaiah 61 and verse 10. "I will greatly rejoice in the Lord. My soul shall exult in my God, for he has clothed me with the garments of salvation," dressing up his bride. That was the rule in the ancient world, by the way. The bridegroom had to buy the bride's dress. He also had to buy the dress for all the guests. Must have been terribly expensive. "He has clothed me with the garments of salvation. He has covered me with the robe of righteousness, his own righteousness. As a bridegroom decks himself with a garland, and as a bride adorns herself with jewels. Chapter 62 and verse 4, wonderful passage. You shall no more be termed forsaken, and your land shall no more be termed desolate, but you shall be called Hephzibah. My delight is in her, and your land will be called Beulah, which means marriage country. Oh, this is a great thing. Are you drinking this in tonight? That when Christ looks at us, he sees the beauty of himself. Absolutely wonderful. Let me tell you about a wedding in Holy Town. It taught me a lesson. I think it's humbled me a bit. It was one of those awful weddings, so dreadful weddings. The boy and the girl, they weren't Christians, but they wanted a church wedding. And they came from very rough homes, very coarse, poor, rough sort of homes, primitive. And when she came into the church up the aisle, I thought, oh dear, poor lassie, what a mess. She tried to do her best, you see, to look like a bride. And she appeared to be wearing a lace curtain. She couldn't get a proper veil, so she just used a lace curtain, which was torn, you know, into the bargain. And her dress was appalling. It's an ancient old ivory satin thing. Very passé and whatever relative had worn. It was all crumpled. She'd not even ironed it, you know. Straight from the suitcase under the bed. Awful. And God said, Tom Swanston, you snob. You snob. Because when she came up to the chap, and when she saw how proud he was of her, and how he loved her, she changed. She looked beautiful. The poor, poor wee lassie with the awful, awful dress. She changed. He was quite a nice looking fellow. I could well imagine that he projected his beauty into the girl. She actually looked bonny, and you could see it in her eyes. Her love for him and his love for her. The beauty of the bride comes from the bridegroom. Secondly, the beauty of their relationship. You see, this boy and this girl have a very rich relationship because it's a relationship that embraces many kinds of love. You see this in the various names that they use of each other. I wonder if you noticed this while we read the passage, that sometimes he calls her his sister. That's a queer thing to call your wife, isn't it? A sister. Sometimes it's my love. Sometimes it's my bride. And then she calls him husband, but she also calls him my friend. Now, you gentlemen here tonight, does your wife ever tell you that you are her friend? Lover, of course. Husband, of course. Lord, of course. New Testament, sorry. You need scissors and paste if you want to remove that. Lord. But my friend, isn't that lovely? You see, they're all different sorts of love. Verse 9 of chapter 4. He says, you've ravished my heart. My sister, my bride. Verse 10. How sweet is your love, my sister, my bride. How strange. Verse 12. a garden locked is my sister, my bride. Chapter 5 and verse 1. I come to my garden, my sister, my bride. Verse 2. I slept, but my heart was awake. Hark, my beloved is knocking, she says. And he says, open to me, my sister, my love. Verse 16 of chapter 5. She says about him, his speech is most sweet, and he's altogether desirable. This is my beloved, she says, and this is my friend. That's a different kind of love. This is my beloved, and this is my friend. Verse 8, chapter 8 and verse 1, I beg your pardon. Oh, that you were like a brother to me. That's another relationship, you see. Different kind of love. That nursed at my mother's breast. Oh, that you were a brother to me. You know, I think it's very misleading that the silver screens of Hollywood and television convey the impression that there's only one kind of love in marriage. One kind of love in marriage, namely erotic love. And I wouldn't be surprised if the spiraling divorce rates of our generation have their roots here, that young boys and girls are conditioned to believe that marriage is all about one kind of love. I tell you that as sure as night follows day, those who get married believing there's only one kind of love in marriage, erotic love, they are doomed to a life of boredom and misery. They're bored with each other after a year or two. Sometimes the arrival of children keeps the interest alive and keeps the marriage going and keeps the love alive. Because when babies come to a home, come to a marriage, new responsibilities enter the home. A child is an everlasting soul. Did you know that? A child is an everlasting soul, destined for heaven or hell, not just a byproduct of human love. But in a real marriage, there are all sorts of love, not just erotic love, but affection love. That's different. And friendship love. That's different too. He calls her a sister. She says, you're my sister, as well as my lover. She says, well, you're my friend, as well as my husband. I'm sure if young couples learned this, maybe old couples too, it would make for marriages that were richer and sweeter and fuller. Our friend puts it like this, that erotic love is that, face to face, a man and wife, a boy and a girl, looking at each other's eyes and a bit preoccupied with each other. You know how sweethearts can be very taken up with each other, so much so they're not interested in anybody else or anything else, you know? That's erotic love. But friendship love is that. Joining hands, walking side by side, and looking at something in common. Your friends have to have something in common. They're interested in music, or singing, or golf, or hobbies, or collecting stamps. Now I think that in marriage, that kind of love is just as important as that kind of love, because it's important that husbands and wives should be friends and do things together as friends, not as lovers or husband and wife, but just because they're friends and have common interests. A rich, rich relationship. And to apply it to the gospel, it is so with Jesus Christ. Our relationship with him is a rich relationship. He is our lover. He is our friend. Isn't this in one of Isaac Watts's hymns? Jesus, my lover, my husband, my friend, my brother, my saviour, all kinds of relationships, a rich love affair with Jesus Christ, the beauty of their relationship, and lastly, the beauty of her separation for him. Verse 12, it's beautiful, let's think of it chastely. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A garden locked, a fountain sealed. There are two applications here. There's the natural. Let's take the natural first. The natural always comes first, according to the Bible. Paul says that which is natural comes before the spiritual. The reference in this verse is to the girl's purity. Her separation. She is keeping herself for her boy. Imagine a garden walled, preserved for its Lord. A memory from my boyhood. We used to be fascinated by the walled garden of Sheriff Walker, who lived on the outskirts of Portsoy. He was then the sheriff of Bampshire. And we used to pinch apples. But we didn't damage the trees as they do now. That's different. It was still wicked. I mean, it's not righteous because you don't break the branches. We were always fascinated that this was a garden with very high walls. We couldn't understand why it was so well preserved and well guarded. And so, greatly daring, we did break into Sheriff Walker's garden. The consequences if we'd been caught. But it was exciting. It was the daring of it that made it exciting, you know. The New Testament speaks about the pleasures of sin. The pleasures of sin. It also says that they endure for a season. So we broke in, and then we found the reason for the high walls. There was a south-facing wall, and trailing against it, oranges, tangerines, and apricots. Lovely. The privacy of it. Incidentally, we didn't touch them, because they were too rare, too exotic. It was too dangerous that we thought it would have been cruel, because there weren't many of them growing. Beautiful. But the privacy of it. A garden walled is my beloved, a fountain sealed. She's keeping herself for our boyfriend. You know that three times in the book of Solomon, the girl says this verse. See that ye awake not love until he please. We shouldn't provoke love in others heedlessly or thoughtlessly. That's why I think that Christians in particular shouldn't wear provocative clothes, erotic clothes. I think a Christian girl's clothing should be demure and modest. Anything else makes a girl look cheap. I don't think Christian girls should look cheap. They certainly shouldn't wear clothes that are going to provoke love or worse in a boy's mind. And it's the same with young men too. I don't think Christian boys should wear provocative clothes. They should dress respectably and smartly, and certainly not in a slovenly way. But they shouldn't wear clothes that provoke girls to love them. It's quite wrong. It causes a great deal of harm and hurt and heartbreak. There's a time for love, according to the Bible, that old-fashioned book. Out of date? It's more contemporary than tomorrow. There is a time for love, and there's a time to refrain from loving. And if you belong to the Lord, he'll tell you who your girlfriend is. And he will tell you when the time for love is. But she says, see that ye awake not love until he please. A garden sealed is my beloved. A fountain sealed, a garden walled. Now that's the natural. And the spiritual comes now. It refers to Christians. Christians are God's peculiar people, God's special people, God's separated people. Christians are not like any other people. You may rub shoulders with nice people during the week. You may talk with them. You may be friendly with them. You can do business with them. But if you belong to Jesus and they don't, then you are absolutely different from them. Completely. You know that there are churches in England called Royal Peculiars. You know that, in the Church of England. Not very many, but sort of special. These churches have a special status. They're called Royal Peculiars. They are under the direct authority of the throne, and the Queen runs them from the throne. Now, Christians are Christ's royal peculiars. We are a different people. Listen to these words. God says, you shall be my own possession among all peoples. You shall be to me a separate nation. Exodus 19. Deuteronomy 14. You are a people separated for the Lord your God. And the Lord has chosen you to be a people for his own possession. Deuteronomy 26. The Lord declares this day that you are a people for his own possession. What about the New Testament? Well, 1 Peter 2. You are a chosen race, a holy nation, a people for God's possession. A garden walled is my beloved, a fountain sealed. Later on, she goes on to speak about a garden full of fruit trees, and she says, come north wind, come south wind, come adversity, come prosperity, come the hard winds, come the gentle winds, and let them blow the perfume into the world outside. Let me ask you, is that what your life is like tonight as a Christian? A walled garden, a private spring, kept for him. Are the winds blowing through the garden and wafting the perfume into the world outside? Is your garden his garden, bearing fruit for him? That's why he chose you to be his garden. May God give us grace to be what he has made us.